Good evening. Welcome to Left, Right and Center. I'm Vishnu Shom. On the program tonight, it's 1 year since the Galwan skirmish between Indian and Chinese soldiers, the worst, bloodiest incident between the two nuclear powers since the 1962 war. 20 Indian soldiers were killed in action. China accepts it lost 4 men. India believes that number is much higher. A year later, just where are India and China? Two very special guests tonight. First, Ambassador Gautam Bambawala, the former Indian ambassador to Beijing and one of the finest minds in the country on the topic of China. Also joining us, the former Northern Army commander, Lieutenant General D.S. Hooda. Second on the show, there is a difference between the constitutionally guaranteed right to protest and terrorist activity, is what the High Court has said, as it granted bail to 3 activists arrested more than a year ago in connection with riots that followed protests against the Citizenship Amendment Act. How is this a huge win for the right to dissent in India? And finally, at 9:30 p.m. this evening, a very special interview with the one and only Sachin Ramesh Tendulkar ahead of the finals of the World Test Championship. He speaks to my colleague Rika at 9:30. But first, today is a very important day. A year back, 20 Indian soldiers were killed in action in Galwan. It was a decisive battle which lasted several hours, and it marked a descent in the relationship between India and China, which is fairly unprecedented. A year later, while the Indian Armed Forces, the Indian Army particularly, has been able to ensure that there have been no major breaches that have taken place in eastern Ladakh, the fact of the matter is that in areas where the Chinese did come in, whether it is Depsang to the north or Hot Springs or Gogra, there are still Chinese incursions. And nobody knows when the Chinese will actually go back. Well, let me go across now to Ambassador Bambawale. Sir, thanks very much for being with us. I asked you this a year back. Why did the Chinese do this? And I'll ask you this a year later. Are we any closer to knowing?
Yeah. I think over the past 1 year, Vishnu, we have had enough time to analyze this question, and my answers to you will basically remain the same. One, there is a tactical answer to your question, which is that the Chinese wanted to move their ground positions to what they conceived or they think is their line of actual control between India and China. At the strategic level, there is a much more, there's a different message which the Chinese are sending, and which is that they are the foremost Asian power today. And in this hierarchy of nations which they believe in, China is the super, the superpower in Asia, and that other nations like India or even Japan should understand their place in this pecking order. So these are the two reasons why they seem to have done what they did in eastern Ladakh.
Is it your belief, Ambassador, that the Chinese have come up to a point which they believe is their territory as of what they stated in 1959 in dialogue with New Delhi at that stage, and therefore what they're trying to do is convert the LAC into the LOC, that is the line, the de facto border?
Look, Vishnu, I don't believe that we should talk about the 1959 LAC or the 1960 LAC or even what the line that existed after the 1962 conflict. The fact is that the Chinese have done something in 2020 and which continues even today in up till 2021. We're in June of 2021, and we need to face up to those facts on the ground. And I have been arguing that if India is to rise to this challenge, and this is not merely a military challenge, it is actually an economic challenge, it is a technological challenge, it's a military challenge, because there is a huge gap, a huge asymmetry in power between India and China. That was a necessary condition for China and the Chinese PLA to have done what they did last April and May, and which they continue to do even today.
Ambassador, would you say that what we saw or what we continue to see in Ladakh is the covert end of what the Chinese are trying to do, militarily push in, whereas what we are seeing in Arunachal Pradesh with villages just on the line of control, or in some cases, even in territory which is within what we consider ours, a more covert, more insidious effort at salami slicing of our territory?
Yes, I tend to agree with that view, Vishnu, especially, you know, what you said at the end, the salami slicing part of it, because the Chinese have done exactly that in the South China Sea. And the idea of salami slicing is you take small steps or small measures at every, you know, every time. None of those small steps is enough to create a war or a conflict. But when you look at what has happened over a series of steps, over a period of time, over several years, you'll see that, you know, a lot has changed on the ground. And I totally agree with you that that is what they have been attempting to do in eastern Ladakh. And the Indian reaction, which has been relatively strong, not only in military terms, but also in policy terms, has put them on the back foot, has shocked them. But I think they are not giving up whatever they have, you know, wherever they have come up to as far as eastern Ladakh is concerned.
Let's talk about the Quad. China says essentially that it's rubbish, it doesn't matter. India believes that the Quad is the way forward. Is it your belief that the Quad, which is, you know, more a talk shop at one level now, despite the military training exercises, can effectively be a military counterbalance to China?
What I just said a couple of questions earlier, Vishnu, is that India needs to look at it from the long-term perspective. And in a longer-term perspective, what India needs to do to rise to this China challenge, and it's not merely a military challenge, it's a technological challenge, it's an economic challenge, it's a comprehensive national power challenge, is to reduce the asymmetry between India and China. Today, as you know, if you just use GDP, the Chinese economy is roughly $14.5 trillion. India's economy is $2.9 trillion worth. So there's this huge gap in abilities between India and China. In the long term, we need to reduce that. But in the short term, where this gap continues to exist, the way forward for India is to build balancing or countervailing coalitions. And we can do this with several countries in the world. The major democracies in the world are, our partners in this. And the Quad, which brings together just four countries, the United States, India, Japan, and Australia, is one such example. And you will have seen that the Quad has moved quickly over the past 7 to 8 months. There has already been a meeting at the leaders' level, even though it was virtual. Mm-hmm. But I believe that the Quad has already moved beyond being a talk shop, and it is moving in the direction of being a balancing or a countervailing coalition vis-a-vis Chinese power, at least in Asia or in the Indo-Pacific, if you will.
Is it possible for India to set the economic ties between India and China aside?
Look, I would say that in today's globalized world, it's difficult to have a complete decoupling between the Indian economy and the Chinese economy. But at the same time, there are certain measures and steps which we need to take for our own national interest. And I believe that these steps have already been taken and have started being taken. The banning of Chinese apps is one example. The fact that we have kept Chinese firms like Huawei out of the 5G trials is an example. I would also like to see that in the future, India is manufacturing certain goods which we import from China in large quantities. For example, APIs in the pharma sector, active pharmaceutical ingredients. India can manufacture them here locally. I believe that we are going to be doing this. So what I think is going to happen is not a complete decoupling of the Indian and Chinese economies, but we are going to have less of China in our economy rather than a China-less economy.
All right. Well, let's see how this pans out. Unfortunately, that line of actual control continues to be tense. One just hopes that it remains peaceful. Ambassador Mambavale, thank you very much for joining me this evening. Well, joining me at this stage, Lieutenant General J.S. Huda, the former Northern Army commander. General Huda, how vulnerable or how defensive, in a sense, is the Indian Army now in parts of eastern Ladakh, specifically Debsang, Gogra, and Hot Springs.
So, Vishnu, when you are saying how defensive is it, I think they would have built up adequate strength and adequate capability and ability in these areas. Not only in the areas, as you mentioned, Gogra, Hot Springs, and Debsang, they would have certainly built up, all across the LSE in eastern Ladakh, seeing which are the vulnerable areas. We were surprised, Vishnu, what happened last year. So I'm sure the army has, done its bit, and it would have built up in these areas. I think the larger question is, you can build up in these areas. I mean, how do you get an agreement for disengagement in these areas? And that's the larger point. And I think that it's not a completely sort of military solution that you will find.
But that's just the problem. They don't appear to be interested in going back. They don't appear to be genuinely interested in military talks beyond what has taken place right now. So would you say that this is an attempt at essentially maintaining the status quo? They've gone back from South Pangong, North Pangong also. They've gone back to a large extent. So therefore, whatever they have in areas which we believe are ours, completely ours, they're going to stay on over there.
So, Vishnu, I think we shouldn't make the mistake of looking at this as a military problem. I think we need to look at it in a larger context of how bilateral relations are taking place at the larger sort of geopolitical picture. How did the one agreement that we've had at Pangong, so how did that take place? And I think the stage was set by high-level political meetings. Mm. So in September, we had, the defense ministers meet, we had the foreign ministers meet. In the foreign ministers meet, they came to a five-point consensus on how things should go. So I think that's how issues are going to get resolved. If we think core commander-level meetings are going to decide issues about territories, or whether this, we are able to withdraw or not withdraw, I don't think that mandate is there with the military commanders.
Sure.
What I'm seeing, Vishnu, and probably because of the pandemic and the second wave that has come, the level of engagements, the discussions that had taken place have completely sort of slowed down.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem to be any urgency on either side, to come to some kind of resolution. As I said, we haven't seen any high-level political contacts. Between June of last year and January, we had 9 core commander level meetings. Between January and June, we've had only 2. And I'm now seeing, some reports saying that the Chinese are saying from core commander level meetings, let's bring it down to major. So, Vishnu, I think both sides need to give an impetus to this, because I fear carrying on like this also has enormous risks that we are taking.
Yeah, which brings me to my final question. The young Indian soldier deployed in eastern Ladakh is not just going to be deployed in some of those areas in summer months. They're going to be deployed permanently now in a lot of those areas. That's an incredible expense. It is an incredible logistical challenge. It is an incredible manpower challenge. And that's not something that's a profound change. The Indian Army will have to change in its deployment in eastern Ladakh perhaps forever. How much of a challenge is that?
So it is a challenge, Vishnu. I can tell you from my own experience, because the advanced winter stocking or catering for troops who will stay through winters into Ladakh when it is completely cut off by road and everything has to be sort of air maintained used to be one of our biggest challenges when we were planning it. It used to, take a year of planning for the next year. So when you are looking at additional troops coming into that area, it is going to be hugely challenging, not only for the army, Vishnu, it's going to be hugely taxing for the Air Force.
Yeah.
Because they'll have to put in additional aircraft, which are frankly meant for wartime, to do peacetime duties constantly. It's also going to impact on our revenue budget, and the army's revenue budget, is already very sort of stressed. More than 80% goes into revenue. So if you're going to add those revenue costs is going to impact on modernization and capital expenditure. So there are costs to be paid for, you know, additional deployments that you are going to do in Ladakh. How are we going to manage it in times of stress budget is something I think that's going to occupy the attention of the military leadership.
Yeah. Well, General Huda, difficult times. It's unfortunate that we should be discussing this even a year later. It's not really been resolved at all in the way that we wanted. It's quite clearly a new front which remains. Thank you, sir, very much for being with us.
Thank you.
There's a difference between the constitutionally guaranteed right to protest and terrorist activity is what the Delhi High Court has said as it granted bail to three activists arrested more than a year ago in connection with riots that followed protests against the controversial citizenship law. The High Court also said that the use of the anti-terror law, the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, which was invoked to file charges against the activists, must recognize the essential character of terrorism and a terrorist act, and that the law could not be casually applied to criminal acts. Natasha Narwal and Devangana Kalita, who are members of the women's rights group Pinjra Tod, and the Jamia student Asif Iqbal Tanha, were arrested in May 2020. They were accused of being masterminds of the February 2020 violence and denied regular bail by the trial court. Let's just go through some of the key observations which were made. In fact, this is all part of the order by the Delhi High Court. The right to protest peacefully, not outlawed, and it is not a terrorist act. That's what Justice Anoop Bhambani and Justice Siddharth Mridul have ruled. In its anxiety to suppress dissent in the mind of the state, the line between the right to protest and terrorist activity seems to be getting blurred. If this mindset gains traction, it would be a sad day for democracy, perhaps the strongest statement of all. The phrase terrorist act cannot be casually applied to criminal acts that fall under the IPC. Such serious sections must be applied in a just and in a fair way. The foundations of our nation stand on surer footing than to be likely to be shaken by a protest. And the complete lack of any specific, particularized factual allegations, foisting grave penal provisions frivolously upon people would undermine intent of the law meant to address threats to the nation. So these are a couple of the very, very strong observation statements made by the High Court. I'm joined now by the senior Supreme Court lawyer Indra Jaisingh, also the senior Supreme Court lawyer Ashwani Dubey, and Sagar Gonzalez, the son of Vernon Gonzalez, who's also in a different case but also been accused of being part of a plot, of a conspiracy, joins us. Ms. Jaisingh, the words used by the two judges in the Delhi High Court, very strong. Is this a victory for the right to dissent in India?
Vishnu, I think it's more than just a victory for the right to dissent. It's a victory also for the independence of the judiciary, which falls outside the framework of what governments do and don't do. And they base their decisions strictly on their understanding of the Constitution of India. So what is spectacular about this judgment is it distinguishes a riot from a terrorist act. So they say very clearly, it is not our case that there may not have been a riot in which there was violence, but that is very different from a terrorist act. And the problem that we have seen with the UAPA cases is that governments tend to conflate any dissent or protest against a policy or a law with a protest against the nation. Now, this is what this judgment puts on record very clearly, that this is not an act of terrorism because nobody is attacking the sovereignty of India. Nobody is attacking the defense of India. And therefore, it is not a terrorist act. If it is not a terrorist act, you can't keep these people in jail for indefinite periods of time. And that is why the court grants them bail today.
Mr. Dubey, one of the perhaps the strongest statement made by the court today is that if this mindset, in other words, the mindset to lock up people gains traction, it would be a sad day for our democracy. Does that mean that people today who who chose to defy the government and to protest, whether against it's the Citizenship Amendment Act or the National Register of Citizens or anything else for that matter, are on surer footing. They can do that and they don't have to worry about being jailed.
Thank you very much, Vishnuji, for having me with you. Right to peaceful protest is a constitutional right flowing from Article 19(1)(a) of the Constitution. And if protest becomes violent and crosses the ambit of Article 19, then it will be punishable under the provisions of law, that is under Penal Code 153 and 505. What the judgment today is, the UAPA, which was invoked against these three persons, that was not maintainable, and Honorable High Court is very well within the ambit of Honorable High Court under Section 439 CRPC to grant bail and also to evaluate the evidences which had been gathered by the police after registration of the FIR. What the Supreme Court, the High Court has said, that terrorist activity is a vague term. Its meaning must be construed narrowly and must be invoked only with respect to the acts having a bearing on the defense of India. So courts are very independent, very rarely it works. And what we have to look into, that each case has to be looked into on its own merits. I'm malicious and wrongful prosecution. We have a very senior lawyer, very eminent lawyer of the country on the panel. Malicious prosecution is one of the cases where there has to be a law if it is found that the police has falsely arrested somebody. But merely giving bail, but as has been said by the Supreme Court, the bail is a matter of right.
How is this not
right,
malicious prosecution?
Jail is exemption.
How is this, Mr. Dubey, not malicious prosecution? If at the end of the day, people who have spent a year in jail are now out of jail with the Supreme Court saying, what on earth is taking place? Why are people being locked up like this? What the High Court has said is, unambiguous.
There is a difference between illegal detention and the lawful arrest. There was an offense registered against them under the various provisions of Indian Penal Code and also under the UAPA Act. So far as the UAPA Act is concerned, the court, Honorable Court, found that both charges have been wrongly invoked against them. But so far as the other offenses invoked and registered against them under the Indian Penal Code is concerned, those offenses are still there. Now, after the leading of the trial, it will be decided whether those persons who have been enlarged on bail were wrongly and maliciously prosecuted and lodged into the jail, or there was a case against them. That will be decided only after leading of the trial.
All right. I just want to go back to Indira Jaisingh for a moment, ma'am. In the last couple of weeks, you've also seen an effort by the Supreme Court on the issue of sedition, to actually say that the word needs to be defined, it needs to be revisited. And now you've got this Delhi High Court verdict over here. Where is this all leading? Is there a recognition that throwing the kitchen sink at citizens who say no or I disagree is not accepted in India?
Vishnu, I think we are a long way from there. Although I'm elated by this judgment, I'm aware of the fact that the challenges ahead are many. If you look closely at the definition of terrorism, it also contains a sentence causing disaffection to the government of India, which is kind of a reproduction of the words used in sedition. So what the UAPA Act does, what the Anti-Terrorism Act does, is it conflates sedition within the definition of terrorist act. And so I think the next challenge, we have met one challenge very successfully, and I'd like to loudly congratulate the lawyers who argued in favor of the three detained persons who hopefully will be released. There is no doubt in my mind that this judgment will be challenged in the Supreme Court of India, and so be it. The challenge will be welcome, provided, of course, the persons are on bail.
Right.
It is one thing to have the luxury of an academic argument in court when you're on bail. It's another thing to be sitting in jail. I would like to tell you that so far as this judgment is concerned, I think it's going to help a lot of people, including the 16 people who are detained in the Bhima Koregaon case. And we have been arguing in the High Court of Bombay that you take the case of the police at the highest
Yeah.
There is no case made out of an unlawful activity because none of these people said, let us secede from the territory of India. Let us attack the defense of India. Let us attack the country as a whole. It was not the case of the police. In that case, they cannot invoke UAPA. And that is the message of this judgment, which I think, yes, it's a great, a great upholding of our fundamental right to speech, to protest. After all, if you're protesting against CAA, you're not protesting against the nation, which is India.
Correct.
You're protesting against the policy of a particular government. And this is the distinction that we need to keep in mind always. Otherwise, you're going to end up in a situation in which you say the prime minister is the nation and the nation is the prime minister. That is simply not the law of the land.
I want to go across to Sagar Gonzalez. Mr. Gonzalez, does this give you hope, this judgment? If you look at the Bhima Koregaon case, if you look at the allegations, the charges, the allegations of war against the nation and questioning, in a sense, the right to dissent, do you believe that there is hope in the case of Vernon Gonzalez over here based on what has happened today?
Yes, Vishnu, I would like to be hopeful because this today's judgment is a really important critique of UAPA and the manner in which it is used. The points that it brings out about the arbitrary nature in which it is applied and the vague definition of terrorism that is being used and how it's just being foisted on people who are actually just dissenting against state police or various unlawful activities of the state and not the people really. And what we've seen happen in Bhima Koregaon is that in the Delhi case, these students were protesting. In Bhima Koregaon, none of these 15, most of these 15 activists weren't even present at Bhima Koregaon. They had nothing to do with it. So their common thread amongst them were they were a group of people who commonly dissented against various policies of the government or various actions of the government, and hence they've been targeted. But there's no case against them, and time again, as a family member, I've been devastated to see how various courts, be it the Sessions Court, the High Court, they've all rejected bail on the grounds of that UAPA. And UAPA, hence, we cannot grant bail because prima facie, that seems to be the case. Even at the Supreme Court level, you had Justice Chandrachud who raised a very important point about dissent being the safety wall of democracy. But then because it was a three-judge bench, the other two judges said that prima facie there is a case. So what really is required, as they've mentioned in today's judgment, is cases have to be analyzed for the actual substance in the case. Now in Bhima Koregaon also, the evidence in itself is at question currently with the Arsenal report. So a revisiting is definitely required in light of this very...
All right. Important points that you mentioned over there. How will today's judgment actually affect the Bhima Koregaon case? I'm out of time. I'd like to thank you all very much for joining us. But this is, in a sense, a landmark judgment, a judgment which strengthens the basic value of our in our democracy, the right to say what you want, dissent, without in any way suggesting that it endorses violence, quite to the contrary. But it does strengthen the basis of which we exist in this country. We'll take a short break.